Greetings from BBS Radio, where truth and news still exist in the original form. You're tuned in to The Spiritual Politician, the show that shows you where politics, government, and selfishness went wrong, and how you can take action to make it right. I'm Melinda Pillsbury Foster, your host for this hour of insight, aimed at making each of us more responsible, more cooperative, and more aware of the spiritual bonds that connect us, no matter what we find to bicker about. You can call us toll-free from the U.S. to 877-876-5227. You can call from Canada, 888-810-8322. Or you can call direct to 530-876-3222. This show is carried online, and you may be also able to get it on the air in your local area. To find out if an old-fashioned on-the-air station in your area carries this show, you can just contact us at bbsradio.com. The website for the show can be found on the BBS Radio site. All past shows become available as soon as it is humanly possible on the station archives. My own blog is called How the Neocon Stole Freedom, and it is at howtheneoconstolefreedom.blogspot.com. Now, my blog this week is on the battle being fought out now over the Bush Library and Policy Center, which the Bush folks want to place on the campus of SMU. Many, maybe a majority of Methodists disagree with this on the grounds that a president who mandates torture is appropriate should never, never be associated with their school. That will be our topic today, so stay tuned. And now some comments on the events we're following that are still in motion. Sad setback in Arkansas. The decision was made to wait in consideration of the ratification of the ERA because the nasty forces of Schlafly, opining the same tired untruths about why those sweet little privileged American women, who are the most privileged and pampered creatures on the face of the earth, might be negatively impacted by having their God-given rights affirmed under the Constitution. Now, I've never actually met one of those sweet, privileged, pampered women she talks about. I know women who care for children, care for their aged parents, and doing several jobs, women who work at Walmart for wages that barely allow them to eat and provide no health insurance. I know women who hide in shelters for battered women and worry, just like they were in Iraq, that if the next time they walk down the street, they could be killed. I know women with the same problems from the DAR, from the National Federation of Republican Women, from business and professional women who understand that this is a reality that women face, both for women in the United States and across the globe. Maybe there are some of those privileged women, but I don't know them. Now, women have always been the force and power behind the movement for social justice here and abroad. To be a woman is to be tied to the processes of life. To be a mother is to experience the need to make the future a place that is welcoming and secure for those who extend us into that future we will never see. This has been true for women in this country since the last battle of the Revolution was still in living memory. But all women do not share these values. There have always been women who looked to burnishing their own bottom line instead. Phyllis Schlafly is such a woman. For the past decades, Phyllis Schlafly has enjoyed a privileged existence that allowed her to have children someone else raised, and at the same time, enjoy the perks and privileges she wants to be the exclusive property of males. It's an ugly reality that she tries to sell. I'd call her a whore, but that would be to do a disservice to prostitutes. And she's sort of long in the tooth for that sort of thing anyway. Make no mistake, the ERA is going to be ratified, even if we have to take steps to rip the rhetorical defenses off everyone at the Eagle Forum and the big corporate interests who fund them. Now, this is how the ERA reads. Equality of the rights shall not, under the law, shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. Notice that it is only governmental entities whose choices are curtailed. Charges that private people and organizations are going to be impacted is just silly. Of course, government, the tool we appoint to enforce government, to enforce justice for us, must be blind to the differences between us. That's only logical. Those are the reasons that we need to pass the ERA. It's just very commonsensical. But people are desperate to keep women from having their rights affirmed under the Constitution for a variety of reasons. Some of them are paid to do that, and that's actually what they've done for a living, and of course that explains Phyllis Schlafly. This is what's actually going on, and the issue's not entirely women. Yes, they want employers to be able to discriminate and pay less, but that's only a side issue. The real issue is how to ensure that they can continue to limit and modify everyone's behavior and personal sovereignty using government, because there's enormous profit there. It might not have occurred to you that laws, statutes, that tell you who you can marry, what your contract will be, what you can say, do, own, and the other limitations and mandates legislation now extrudes faster every day, actually go to benefit those corporations who take legislators out to eat, slip cash in their pockets, and give them jaunts in the corporate jets, the places their sorry selves only dreamed about before they fell into their cushy and privileged lives. Now that's what's happening, just so you know. And now our thought for the week ahead. As the Bush administration continues to spiral into self-destruction on a global scale, taking us with it, driven by an agenda that is strategically brilliant but morally toxic, those associated with that administration continue to seek exits. You'll see many people leaving this administration, and what we're seeing now is only the beginning. That trend will continue. At the same time, the petitions pro and against the inclusion of the Bush Library and Policy Center at SMU continue to draw public attention. At the start of the show today, the total on those stood at, drumroll, 113 supporting the Bush Library and Policy Center, 10,390 against the Bush Library Project. One of the signers in opposition had this to say. They're words that lead perfectly into our subject. Quote, I am, since 1971, a member of Edge Hill United Methodist Church in Nashville, Tennessee. I am former executive director of Restorative Justice Ministries for the General Board of Global Ministries of United Methodist Church, a former coordinator of ministries with the poor and marginalized for the Tennessee Conference of the UMC. President Bush and Vice President Cheney, I understand, are both technically members of the United Methodist Church. Having watched their policies and practices throughout their time in the highest political offices in the land, it has become clear to me that, with one exception, their position on same-sex marriage, all their policies and practices are in violation of UMC social principles. I also understand that President Bush has very seldom attended a UMC church since being elected president and moving to Washington. I think that it would be a major mistake for a United Methodist institution of higher education, no matter how many first ladies and bishops serve on its board of trust, to be the site of a George W. Bush library. I suspect that he has nothing to do with Christian faith or with Methodism, except in name only and for sheer political purposes only. It is time that the church call him to accountability in the best biblical, covenantal, and Wesleyan tradition, and saying no to the library is one way to do that. I called the gentleman, Mr. Y, who wrote that just this afternoon, and he said, by goodness, he stands by it. And he told me about the ministry that he does, and I think that you'll be able to look forward to hearing him on this program in the not-too-distant future, because it's definitely a subject we need to hear more about. Now, tonight we were going to have Dr. Susan Johnson, but she has been detained. And so we're going to have Marilyn Blankenship, who is a lady that I became acquainted with and who actually is the person whose my discussions with whom led me to the whole subject of the SMU Bush Library. Mrs. Blankenship is the lady whose story we followed on occasion, who went out to vote on October 23rd and had her vote miscounted by a Diebold machine. But she's also grew up in the area just near SMU in a house that's still in the family. And she is has a very strong opinion about the sorts of things that the Bush Library and Policy Center could do to the community to which he's still so much attached. Please welcome Mrs. Blankenship. Mrs. Blankenship, are you there?
Yes, I am. My dog is barking. I hope he won't disturb our discussion.
Oh, he won't bother anybody. It's nice to have somebody in the background like that. Well, thanks for being with us today. And we always start by asking our guests to tell us something about themselves. So tell us something about Marilyn Blankenship.
Well, I would like to tell about the Marilyn Blankenship that moved into a community 5 blocks north of SMU. It was a subdivision of about 2 blocks wide and 5 blocks long, and it was called SMU Heights when it was originally platted, and then during the Depression, it was sold to one of the first mayors of University Park and became University Park Addition.
Mm-hmm.
My parents bought a brand new home in this subdivision in 1934.
Hmm.
And SMU was so close to our neighborhood that many of the early professors lived among us and were our neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
So although I did not go to SMU for my college degree, I have been close to that facility and those people for a long, long time.
Mm-hmm. And I bet that was just a big part of your life. I mean, being close to something like that, oftentimes you'll go to the activities on campus because there'll be plays or there'll be concerts.
Oh, yes. And McFarlane Auditorium was a place where many activities took place. They had civic music concerts and things like that that people from all over Dallas would attend because it was a large auditorium, and we didn't have the Fair Park Auditorium until the centennial came about 1937 or 38. So SMU was at that time a very important part of the Park City, and the little town of University Park grew up around SMU.
Mm-hmm.
Holland Park grew up around the Dallas Country Club, but the people who lived in University Park were interested in a good education for their children, and the Holland Park Methodist Church had not become the United Methodist Church then. It's where we went to school and where our friends went to church, and where our friends from school were there too.
So that was a big part of your life too, going to the church.
Yes. That's where I had most of my high school friends, was in my church group.
Mm-hmm.
People I still know and love.
Well, and that's a community is just an extension of our family.
That's exactly right.
And so you've, of course, watched the area sort of grow up and change some, and it's continued to be very much in a part of your life, right?
Yes. My parents never sold their home. They kept it. And when they passed away, it was inherited by the sister and myself. And now my daughter is a resident there. So it is a part of the community, and it has a Park City's Preservation Medallion on it because we don't want it torn down and another property built on it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can understand it. I mean, it's been a part of your life for so long. And your daughter lives there. Is she very much a part of the community there, too?
Oh, yes. We worked hard when she moved in 1995. There were a lot of things that were happening in University Park that needed some people to attend to, and the school district was where we got our first wind of we needed to help, and she worked with that. I don't live in University Park. I live in another part of Dallas, but we've been active in our own way, and especially Beth, because she loved her grandparents, and she loves their house, and she loves her neighborhood, and so we just keep on trying to be a positive influence in the community.
And you actually were involved in ascertaining why there had been eminent domain used in your old neighborhood, right?
Well, in University Park, we have had some eminent domain problems, and that's one of the reasons that everybody is concerned about the library, is because many of us have watched SMU try to expand its campus through taking properties that are owned by other people. And this didn't come about until they put the ballpark in Arlington, and the people in the Rangers ballpark group wanted to take property between the expressway that is there and the ballpark, and they have the law for eminent domain passed so that they could take some property from the Mathis family. And that's where the eminent domain got started around here.
Was that just before George Bush was elected governor?
This is when he was working with the Rangers.
Yes, before he
was the governor. And it was quite a story, because the Mathis family were part of the Curtis Mathis television group.
Right.
And they didn't want to sell their land for what the Rangers wanted to buy it for. But the Rangers did another thing that was a little bit under the table, and that was that they formed some sort of, I don't know exactly how to explain it, but it was sort of like a holding company, except it was for the city of Arlington, which would give it clout to take the land, and the Mathis refused to sell, and it was a long, drawn-out process. Eventually, they did have to sell, but they got a much better price for what they had to sell than what they were offered, and they had legal battles, and people in this part of the state know all about that. And
what you got out of it, though, is you saw just how completely unethical the people associated with Bush could be, and you could see how they would use something like eminent domain, which is supposed to be only where necessary for roads and other public developments, for something like a stadium.
Yes, but when they incorporated it with the Arlington government, they got the Arlington people to pay so much sales tax and form this group, then it became a government thing.
Mm-hmm.
And when they tried to take houses in University Park for the school district, they used the same idea. Well, this is for the public use of the school district. And they did it once, but the second time they tried to do it, they were unable to, because the people in the community would not vote the bonds to the school district to buy the land.
Mm-hmm.
And this is when a long-range plan for SMU's campus came to light.
Now, what year was this?
What?
What year?
What? I beg your pardon?
What year was this?
This was in 1995.
Ah, so it's a while ago.
Not too long ago, 95, 96.
Okay.
And there was a map that came to view that was published in the newspaper that showed that SMU wanted to expand their boundaries to fit around this proposed school that was going to be built close to where the campus is.
Uh-huh.
And when that was exposed, then everybody realized that the school that they were proposing would probably be built for the school district, but then if the school district wanted to give it to SMU as a demonstration school, then SMU would be able to continue to take property to expand the campus.
So they had found a way to continue to simply kind of extend out and taking more and more land in the community.
And every time they take more land around them, it displaces people who have homes. And this is a landlocked campus. They need to move to another location and stop buying places and then eventually saying they buy them and then they rent them. And then when they get enough of the properties, why, they take everybody else's.
And
this happened in a condominium very near the site where they say they don't know where that's where the library's going, but everybody knows that's exactly the place they're going to put it.
Mm-hmm.
There was a set of condominiums, and they began to buy them one by one until they had an equity in the complex, and then they told all the other residents that they had to move.
And they forced them to move eventually.
Yes.
But there were a lot of losses.
Yes, and there was a Ms. Baird's bread factory up there, which they gobbled up. It's across from the campus. And there's a shopping center up there that they gobbled up. And this site that they want to put the library and the institute on, nobody knew anything about the institute until recently. And that came through the faculty at SMU. They were not even aware of how it was to be set up. But the properties that they are thinking about building this library on are adjacent to Mockingbird Lane, which is a through street through our University Park and Holland Park, where many, many people travel. It's only for three or four cars.
Mm-hmm.
And then they want to use Central Expressway. And this land is adjacent to Mockingbird Lane and Central Expressway.
Mm-hmm.
And after they got the condominium complex, they had to go in and get some homes that were duplexes, and we understand now that three of the owners of those duplexes have held out and have not sold, and there is another house that has not sold. And they're trying to get a park from the city, a very small park, and the city has scheduled a vote by the citizens for May in order to see whether the city can sell this park. So their parcel of land for the Bush Library is not yet complete, but they act as if it's a done deal. And when the faculty at SMU realized that the library was going to have separate parks, then they became very involved.
Mm-hmm.
And for the last month, they have been trying to get the real facts of what is to be built there.
Mm-hmm. Yes, because, of course, and I've heard it said that they think a library is bad enough, but the idea that this presidency would have a policy center is sort of shocking.
Well, and the other thing that bothers me is that he claims he's a member of Holland Park United Methodist Church, and yet he doesn't live here. He lives in Crawford when he comes back to Texas. And that church is my church. That's
mm-hmm.
the church that I grew up in. And it's very different now than it used to be.
What
and then they bought property in Highland Park to build them a house. And all of this has been done very quietly while SMU has been collecting the land to build his library and his legacy. And the people in the community are just left dangling until the facts gradually creep out.
So you're saying what's happened is this has happened very covertly, and they've continued to simply slip things in there, like they did with using the eminent domain to take land for a school that they actually, you believe, intend to have be part of this larger facility for SMU.
Well, the stealth that these people feel that they can get by with is what concerns just ordinary citizens, because we are told that everything is supposed to be open and above board, and yet when you have to find out after the fact, that's not very comforting, nor does it build trust.
No, it wouldn't, and it's certainly not the way Christians are supposed to relate to each other, and this is a Methodist university.
Yes, it is, and it is under the jurisdiction of the Methodist Church, regardless of how the Board of Trustees sees it. And the interesting thing is that the people that are on the Board of Trustees of SMU right now are not necessarily all people from Dallas. I mean, they've been chosen for certain reasons,
mm-hmm.
and even if they are from Dallas, they had some connection that made them target to be on the board. And some of them have been involved in buying this property.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I thought it for me to say that Ray Hunt put up the money to buy the shopping center that will be displaced on Mockingbird and Central Expressway.
Mm-hmm.
And he is on the board of trustees.
And so what you're doing is entirely changing the character of the community and seeming to have no regard for the people whose community it is because they live there.
And I'd like to make one more statement. They did not do anything about parking for SMU as it grew. And those cars that children drive to school now, they're not children, they're grown, but they sometimes act like children, parked all through our subdivision. And finally, the city of University Park made SMU build some parking garages to get those cars off of our residential streets because the fire trucks couldn't even get up and down where those students were parked.
Mm-hmm. So you don't see SMU as having been a responsible neighbor at all?
It is a bad neighbor, and anybody who lives close to it will say that.
And it sounds like they're simply... I know from what I've heard, what you've said and other people have said about the condos, too, that's caused a tremendous amount of bad feeling because the people living in the condos, for the most part, were elderly people who had decided this was going to be their final home.
Yes. The condos were built back when there were people in the Park Cities who didn't want to leave there, but they were too old to stay in their home. And so that was why the condos came to be built. And they were very close to Central Expressway. They wedged them into a little place that was available close to Central and close to Mockingbird Lane, but they could still be in the Park Cities. And some of my mother's daddy's very good friends bought condos and moved up there. But when they died, then other people began to buy them. And that's how SMU got a hold of them. And then the people would die, they would buy the condo. And the first thing the residents knew, SMU was the major shareholder in that University Gardens complex. And then they made everybody else move, whether they wanted to or not. They gave them a check and said, you leave. And there was one man who did everything he could to stay because he owned his own apartment and three others. And they finally forced him out just about 3 or 4 months ago. He went mm-hmm. through every legal maneuver he knew.
And he did that because this was also his community.
And they needed this land for this Bush complex that they want to put up.
Mm-hmm. How has this impacted people in the community and how they look at Bush?
Well, it depends on whether they're old University Park residents or whether they're new University Park residents. The people who have a strong sense of the history of University Park see things entirely different than the ones that have just moved in and probably won't stay. And there's a lot to be said for the history of that little city. And if you believe in its history, then you do not feel that what's happening in the present is in the best interest of the history of University Park.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell us something about the history of the University Park, because it sounds to me like people love it.
Well, it is. It's a wonderful location. It's about 5 miles from downtown Dallas, and it incorporated back when SMU was young. Now, the city of Highland Park is smaller, and it incorporated quite a while back, but it came to be because of the Dallas Country Club, and everybody who bought a big lot in Highland Park had a membership in the Dallas Country Club. But University Park grew up around Southern Methodist University, and there were many professors who lived in my subdivision that was about 2 blocks wide and about 5 or 6 blocks long. And I've forgotten what you asked me to tell you about.
No, you were telling me about the kind of community it is.
Oh, the kind of community, yes. And the Highland Park Methodist Church was up on the campus. It was to be the University Park Methodist Church, but the early members, so many of them, lived right across Mockingbird, which is the dividing line between University Park and Highland Park. that one night at a meeting, they said, why don't we change the name to Highland Park Methodist Church? But it's actually in University Park.
Uh-huh.
University Park is bounded by Northwest Highway, Central Expressway,
mm-hmm.
Mockingbird Lane, and then it goes over to the west, I think, to Mockingbird, but I may be mistaken. And then Highland Park picks up and is the rest of the Park City.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway,
I
lived there as a little girl before my parents moved into their house when I was 2 1/2, and I lived there until I married and moved away.
And so that's really the only home you remember.
Oh, yes, and my daughter lives in that home now. So we have deep roots and longtime friends and neighbors, and, you know, it's home.
It's home, and it's hard, I guess, to see this happen to the place that you love, that, you know, all of your memories go back there. It must be hard to watch the, you know, what's going on with the church, too, because I know that from what I've heard, the church has sort of changed character.
Well, the church has been boxed in by SMU. When they built the new stadium, they put it so close to the church that there's not much parking left, and you have to park in an SMU facility if you go to church. They let you go and park in a multi-story thing, and if you don't want to go there, the parking for the church is very limited. SMU just has spread everywhere, and putting this library up there will just make mass congestion for the community, and we've got enough cars that we don't have double freeways or double laned every anything. We're just a small town that everything grew around.
Mm-hmm.
University Park was a small town. It has a small city hall when they have a community meeting. Very few people can get into the chambers. They have to stand out in the hall and watch the television. And we're just not equipped for a big mass of people. And our cars take up our streets now. And if we have a Bush library and all the other congestion that'll come with it, it's not good for the community. And that's the way the community feels. They had a meeting the other night.
Tell us about that.
Well, I didn't go, but my daughter did, because she's a resident down there. And the main concern of the people who live down there is that if they put the Bush Library up here at SMU, what are they going to do about the terrorists that come?
Well, that's an interesting question, because I'm sure that George Bush is not a very popular person with anybody who's a terrorist.
Well, there'd be no way that they could keep the airspace from being infiltrated, and they may have airplanes that fly around down around Crawford and keep the airplanes they don't want out of the way, but they could never keep airplanes away from the SMU campus or the Bush Library or anybody else for that matter. We don't have any homeland security, and our community doesn't want, I say our community because that's where I grew up, the people in that community don't want any outside fears to disrupt their lives.
And that's what they're confronting now. Not only has their land been taken, their community disrupted, but at the same time, they're looking at living in an atmosphere of fear, because this is where he has decided to settle.
Well, and if he comes to live down on the property that he has bought, catty-corner to the Highland Park Police Station, then we've got that to look at. He bought a piece of property at 3901 Euclid, and he's building a house down there. Well, it just disrupts our whole community to have him come in here and take over our lives with his library and institute and whatever else he's going to put there.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the main concerns is that all of the information that might be put into a library, he's put restrictions on through his executive order.
Well, it makes you wonder what people are going to go there and see and what archivists can look at.
Well, if he's got an executive order that you can't see anything going way back into his daddy's history, then what's the point in having this thing there? And the think tank that was going to come along with it has just come out recently. Nobody said that when they started to talk about putting the Bush Library near SMU, but there's going to be a think tank that goes along with it.
Now,
and all this money that is going to be used to build it with, the rumor is that it's not going to be local money. It's going to come from all over the world.
Well,
and there's been $500 million or $200 million. Nobody knows how much money they're going to put into it.
It's a half a billion dollars.
Well, whatever it is, it's not conducive to the University Park community. We have small lots, and we have some houses that have been built on properties that have been torn down, but we're not equipped for mass influx of people.
Mm-hmm.
And we were a quiet university community, and this is going to completely change the way we all live if it comes, and nobody that I know wants it. The old-timers don't want it. The only ones who might want it would be those who have moved in because they thought the Park Cities was a prestigious place to live, and they would think it would be prestigious to have a Bush Library there.
I don't know if you're aware that to the people in Crawford, Texas, when Bush decided to buy his ranch there, I think it was just in 2000. I mean, it was right before he became president, were excited because they thought it was going to give a tremendous surge to their local economy. And so they built gift shops, and they got ready to receive the tourists who would surely come, and that they have been extremely disappointed in that because the controller of the state of Texas keeps records, and very clearly the shops aren't doing well. They tend to do a little bit better. There are more sales when something like the Cindy Sheehan event takes place.
Well, I haven't been to Crawford, but my sister has. She drove down there with her husband on a trip one time. And I don't think it's conducive to people going there because I think they feel like it's part of the Bush. You know, they have airplanes that patrol the skies. They have people who walk around. And anyway, it's not conducive to making tourists come.
Well, that's certainly interesting because that was one of the reasons that the people who, you know, live there were delighted to have it because they believed it would actually become a source of income. And they've been disappointed in that.
Well, I can understand why. And we will be disappointed if this library gets to come here. The faculty at SMU has been kept in the dark about what it actually will or will not do, and they've been working hard to try to get the real facts.
Mm-hmm. I know Dr. Johnson wrote a letter that was co-signed by one of her, one of her fellow faculty members, and it was only about a month ago, and that they hadn't learned very long before that what was really planned.
Well, I think what is most interesting is that SMU just acts as if these four residences that they have not been able to buy do not exist. And I don't know whether they will put those people out of their homes as they did the ones in the University Gardens complex where the older people were living. When
uh-huh.
they got bought enough, they just said, here's your money, leave. And this one man has fought them to the very end. He's a lawyer, an SMU graduate,
mm-hmm.
and he thought it was so unfair the way they sneaked in and started buying up the condominiums, and then when they got enough, were going to put all the rest of them out.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing is happening on a street called Potomac that happens to have a few houses that are adjacent to SMU, and there are three people on that street that are holding out. They have not sold. And there's another one on SMU Boulevard. So there are four houses that they have to route the people from. I guess they can take their houses away from them if they get enough legal power. And then, of course, they have this park that they're going to try to get the citizens of University Park to give them. But if University Park won't give them that park, then they have been stopped as far as their grand plan was concerned. They'll have to work around it.
Well, that's very interesting, and certainly it sounds like the community is very anxious to stop them.
Well, last week they had a town hall meeting at the University Park City Hall where the citizens could come and talk, And this is when the idea of the terrorists hit the fan, because nobody had talked about that. And what's going to happen to the little town of University Park if the terrorists decide to take out the Bush Library or decide to do something about SMU because they allowed it?
Mm-hmm. Well, and that certainly is a possibility. If you take a look at the amount of anger that there must be against Bush, he would certainly personally be a logical target.
Well, and this business of the terrorists, Bush created it. That's what's so scary. And how now it's coming back on the people.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, and of course the people in the little town didn't choose to have this happen to them. It's been visited on them by... Now, it's interesting also if you take a look at the process, because from what you've said and from what I've heard, the trustees for SMU have actually changed, and they've been moving slowly toward making sure that the people who were trustees would support this.
Well, Laura Bush went to SMU, and she majored in education. And I heard her say that she thought that all the people who were trained to be teachers should write to their schools and tell them that they really didn't prepare them for what it would be like when they went into a classroom.
Mm-hmm.
And your listeners probably know that she did not stay in the classroom very long. She went back and happened to go to the University of Texas to get a degree in library science. But her experience as a teacher was limited, and that's the degree that she took from SMU. And then they put her on the board of trustees.
Mm-hmm.
And that's her. That's George Bush's connection to SMU.
So, and you are actually a teacher yourself.
Yes, I made a teacher and taught a number of years in the Texas public schools.
And that was an interesting experience for you, because you saw a tremendous shift in education over the period of time that No Child Left Behind was instituted.
Oh, I can't begin to tell you how things happened in education. I started teaching in 1952. It was most delightful. The older teachers helped younger teachers, and it was just a camaraderie. And then I stopped and had a baby. And then I went back in the 60s, and it was still a good place to work. And then I went back in the 70s, and I don't know what had happened to it. And when I stayed there for the 70s, the 80s, and then I quit in 1993. Because it was just apple box turnover. Texas education was sucked into the, I don't know what to call it. But anyway, we did fine until the 70s. And we tried in Texas to stop the roller coaster of the kind of education that our children get today. But we weren't successful because the money ran out. Our Texas legislature put the teachers on what they call career ladder, and the teachers had to perform, or they didn't get paid, or they got fired. And for several years, this really made a difference. But when the money got tight, they couldn't do that anymore. Then we went back to having just any old body that could stay in the room and the kids would stay with them could become a teacher. I think that's very sad. Our education system in the United States has been truly dumbed down.
Now, in Texas, the funding for schools comes through the petroleum industry, right? Isn't that through there?
Well, we have a different way of funding it, yes. But the individual school districts still have control over what they allow to be taught, you know, and the way they allow to be taught, the way they allow it to be taught.
Uh-huh.
And we just got so far away from the basic things that children need. My teaching experience was in the second and the third grade. And if you don't get a good foundation, you're lost. And we just promote children with poor foundations. My last few years to teach, I would get children in the second grade that really should never have gotten out of the first grade. And I just have to work like anything to get them caught up so they could move on to the third grade. And my principal compliment to me was, "You could teach a chair to read." Oh, that she'll never know how that upset me. I should not have had to be teaching chairs. I should have been teaching children. But I did see to it that nobody left my room without the skills that they needed.
Mm-hmm.
But I got a lot of them those last few years that should never have been out of the first grade. I don't even know how they got out of kindergarten, some of them, because they were just so unprepared.
So you've seen a lot of transitions in Texas in the educational system, and you've seen it in your town where you grew up. And this has probably been disheartening for you.
It is. All we can do is tell what we know and try to make a difference. And that's what people are trying to do about this business of coming that wants to come to SMU. It's not the place to put it. They had other places that could take them. The University of Dallas has a big campus. It's a Catholic organization, and it's across town. But they didn't get the bid. Baylor is in Waco. It's a Baptist university. They are at the edge of town. They could have taken it. But what happens? They want to bring it to SMU that is crowded in among all kinds of homes and put it right on the freeway. And it's not a good place for it, but politics is the name of the game. And that's why it's being put here.
Well, it sounds like that's where he decided he wanted to build his house, actually.
Well, he lived in Dallas before he became the governor. When he was with the Texas Rangers, and they put him in as the front man, he didn't bring the money, he just brought the name. When he came here as part of the Texas Rangers operation, he lived in the city of Dallas. But when he comes back, he wants to live in Holland Park. And that's why he wants this SMU facility, because it is in University Park, but Holland Park and University Park, but right up to one another.
Uh-huh. And this is a very prestigious area?
I beg your pardon?
It's a prestigious area. It's an area
well,
with more
the,
expensive
the
housing.
Thing about University Park and Holland Park is that they incorporated a long, long time ago. They were the edge of Dallas. And when they incorporated, they wanted to have good schools. I went to the Holland Park Independent School District, and that's a marvelous place to be educated because it's a small district, and they always taught you. They didn't get caught up in all kinds of other things. And then the Dallas moved on around us.
Mm-hmm.
And so we became just little islands. And because we're small, University Park is larger than Holland Park.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're small, it was a very small town community atmosphere. The reason my parents decided to live there, my daddy had bought a lot in Lakewood, which is part of Dallas, and he traded that lot for the house that my mother and daddy lived in.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason they decided they'd live there is because it was within walking distance of SMU, and it was going to be a place where people cared about learning.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the big drawing card, that the people there wanted a good education for their children. Now it's become very affluent, and some people move there because they like to say they live in University Park or they live in Holland Park because that gives them an edge over common people. But that's not the intent.
Mm-hmm.
That was not the intent of the Park Cities.
And so what you're seeing is that they're sort of losing their mission, they're losing the sort of their soul, and it's being displaced by simply a sense of wanting to feel like you're elite.
Yeah. And putting this library there, they think that'll make SMU elite. Well, it won't. If SMU can't make it on its own merit, putting that library there is certainly not going to help.
Somehow I don't think that having the Bush Library is going to be a call for elitism in any sort of meaningful sense.
Well, the Methodist Church built SMU, and I can remember when we were having the black people wanting to be accepted everywhere,
mm-hmm.
and they were not accepted at SMU because the tuition was high, and it was a small school. And the way they forced the doors open at SMU was that they went up there and sat on the campus around the administration building until they finally decided that they were going to put scholarships up people who had less money to go to that school to be able to come there. And that's how it became integrated, was mm-hmm. through scholarships that these smart young people earned. But it still costs a lot of money to go to SMU because it's a private university.
Mm-hmm.
And the Methodist Church does not really have as much control over it as it used to have, but they still have to answer to a denomination.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that this Bush Library has been put forth, it's as if, well, that's just a secondary thing. The Methodists really don't have anything to say about it. But there are lots of people who are Methodists who are not happy at all that Gerald Herter, the president, is pushing this on the campus.
You've painted such a beautiful picture of exactly what's really going on there for us. I really want to thank you.
Well, I'm happy I could do it, because if we don't speak out about what we know and what is truth, then people often get misunderstood and get misunderstandings.
And that would be a very bad thing, and it would sort of divide us from each other, which is what we definitely don't want as Christians.
Well, I don't care if Bush builds a library, but I don't really want him to put it at SMU. And if I could vote, that's what I would say, because I don't think that we need it in our community, and there are other places that have the space. He can put it. The University of Dallas has withdrawn their application. They had plenty of space. And Waco, Baylor, still has their door open, so let him put it down there close to Crawford in that part of Texas.
That would sound certainly good to me, and I bet there are lots of people who would agree. Well, I want to thank you for being with us today.
All right.
I've really enjoyed it, and you have just done so much to illuminate what's really going on in the community. You have a good weekend. God bless.
Thank you, Melinda.
Thanks. Bye. And that's our show for today, Friday, February 9th, 2007. Here at The Spiritual Politician, we're working to help individuals find ways to bring government into alignment with the way we know we should be treating others, personally, in business, and at every other point
of our lives. Dial 1 or 0 when calling this.
Freedom and doing the right thing matters in all of our lives. On this show, as we do with all our shows, we end by reading the section of the Declaration of Independence that is America's mission statement. This remains where we want to go today. It's up to each of us to ensure we reach the destination. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundations on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Prudence indeed will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes. And accordingly, all experience has shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations pursuing invariably the same object, evidences a design to reduce them under absolute despotism. It is their right, it is their duty to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. This is Melinda Pillsbury Foster coming to you from BBS Radio. God bless the journey that brings us to freedom, and may God be with you every step of the way. Good night.